Okay, good evening, everyone. I do want to greet you in Jesus' name this evening. Appreciated your devotions, Mark. How we are to be salt and light, and I believe that's by far the most important thing that we can be is live our lives so that we can be a light to others. And a little touched on having a relationship with people. I don't think we can just go out and convince people that we don't know. We can march and carry signs, and I don't know that it does anything other than make for even harder feelings. So how do we reason or reach people who are not Christians? You can't. If a person is a Christian, we can debate the scriptures or we argue the scriptures, but not so much so if someone doesn't believe in the scriptures. It's hard to appeal to God or the scriptures if a person doesn't believe that. So I think it's important to know where a person is coming from, whether they're agnostic or atheist or Hindu or Buddhist or whatever it might be, Muslim. So the communication part, and I'm not going to read a lot of these verses, but when Peter preached in Jerusalem in Acts 2, verses 22 to 41, you guys, you're welcome to read that. It was at Pentecost, and Peter preached, and the Jews, many of them, became Christians. And I guess those people understood where Peter was coming from. He could preach to them because they were Jews. They were either Jews in Jerusalem, dispersed Jews, or proselytes to Judaism. And so, number one, they believed in Creator God. They understood God as a lawgiver and that there were absolutes. They understood that Adam had fallen. And they understood that the penalty for sin is death. Now, a person who doesn't understand that, and also doesn't, you can't reason with them in that regard. So in Acts 17, I want to turn that to that for a little bit. Paul, in the first four verses, he's speaking to... came to Thessalonica, where it was the synagogue of the Jews, and Paul, as his manner was, went in unto them, and three Sabbath days reasoned with them out of the scriptures, opening and alleging that Christ must needs have suffered and risen again from the dead, and that this Jesus whom I preach unto you is Christ. And some of them believed, and consorted with Paul and Silas, and the devout Greeks, a multitude of the chief women, not a few. Okay, so he's alleging, preaching, reasoning, and then, but later on in this chapter, if we go on to verse 18, then these philosophers, the Greek philosophers, came to him, who they said, "Oh, what's this nonsense you're talking about, this resurrection?" So then Paul reasons with them in a different way. He talks to them about, they had this evolutionary concept that they had no concept of the Jewish God, so they didn't have the scriptures, didn't understand Adam or original sin. So he establishes the common ground of the unknown God, and then he goes on, says, look, this unknown God is the one that I'm talking to you about. You're descendants of Adam, this man who sinned. Try and get them to understand that they're sinners and to counteract their wrong religion. And then he returns to the message of the resurrection. So I guess I think people today kind of fall into different categories. We have people who don't believe that there is a God. So those are agnostics or atheists, whatever they might be. And then most people, I think, in America, believe somewhat that there's a God. And a lot of people would confess that they do believe the scriptures, that they believe that God created the world. So I think it makes a difference where those people are coming from. So if people believe that there is a God, but then you have those who believe that don't believe that the inerrancy of the scriptures. So you have this, how do you reason with someone who believes that the scriptures are errant, perhaps? Or some of the, a lot of what I read is sometimes when I see something on the internet, I click on it, read it, and then I read the comments, and that's where I think I get a lot of, sometimes I get sort of depressed when I read people's comments. Seems like a lot of them apparently believe that there isn't a God, that we came about by chance. And so there's no moral absolutes. So how do you reason with someone who doesn't believe that there are moral absolutes? I just want to read a little story. So if you don't believe that there, and then there are those who think that some things are more moral than others. If that's the case, you've already appealed to a higher, you're already stating that there is a higher morality. There's something higher out there. So I think we have to get them to see the inconsistency in their beliefs. And I don't mean that we argue with them or whatever. I think we can reason with them. We can allege and whatever. And I still think that this greatest thing is that we live our lives, that we are that we show love, that we are consistent in our beliefs. I mean, after all, as far as homosexual marriage, not just marriage, but behavior and whatever, how do we, are we consistent in those beliefs? You know, going back to Genesis, and Jesus talked about that when he was whichever group it was in Matthew 19, I believe it is. Ask him about, you know, divorce. Jesus spelled it out how that, and I guess I'll just go there for a little bit. The Pharisees also came unto him, tempting him, saying unto him, is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? And I think there was two different thoughts, two different camps there. Some thought you could put him away for any reason whatsoever, for most trivial things, and others thought, no, it's just adultery and that type of thing. But Jesus says, have you not read that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female, and said, for this cause shall a man leave father and mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh. Wherefore they are no more twain, but one flesh. What therefore God hath joined together, let not man put asunder. They say unto him, why did Moses then command to give a writing of divorcement to put her away? He saith unto them, Moses, because of the hardness of your heart, suffered you to put away your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. And I say unto you, whosoever shall put away his wife, except it be for fornication, and shall marry another, committeth adultery. And whoso marrieth her which is put away, doth commit adultery. So I think we have to be, Jesus is saying, from the beginning, God designed male and female. And one man, one woman, for life. Yeah, even that ideal is corrupted. I mean, there's lots of people who sin who are straight. I mean, there's all kinds of other sins, child pedophilia and rape. So are beliefs consistent with Jesus' teaching, or do people say, well, what about divorce? So I think that's where Christians have gone a little bit astray, is they haven't been consistent in their beliefs. I think abortion is a little bit the same thing. Do we really believe that life is sacred, whether it's in the womb or out of the womb? I mean, the argument is made that, well, you Christians, you only care about life in the womb. I mean, you're not caring about those others after they're born. So do we care about the others after they're born? And there's others. I mean, there's many other things. And I think a lot of this goes down to to what, you know, I think what brought up this topic a little bit was the Supreme Court decision on gay marriage, that gays can be married. So, but I think that marriage is, if they've butchered the meaning, I guess, because it did mean one man and one woman. That was God's original definition. So the state getting involved in marriage has sort of watered that down now. And, but it's still God who, I mean, we are married before God, not before the state, or before the state-appointed person, whoever that might be. So, so I think that we have to argue or allege or however you want to put it, and reason with someone that it is that their beliefs are inconsistent, because if we just come out and say, well, God said so, then they say, well, I don't even believe in God. So I think we have to, and I appreciated Lowell saying that we ask them questions. You know, we ask them, well, then, so if there is, so where did marriage come from? If it wasn't ordained by God, or where did life come from even? So that, I mean, they believe that matter is eternal, and matter without life created life, matter without mind created mind, matter without intelligence created intelligence, matter without morals created morals, matter without conscience created conscience, and matter without purpose created purpose and order. So those are very inconsistent beliefs, I believe, that we don't get to where we're at by chance, random, whatever, life in some scum pond. And so I think, you know, that we have to get them to see that their beliefs are inconsistent. But in order to do that, we have to be consistent in our beliefs. And many of them argue, well, you know, the Mosaic Law was done away with, so we don't have to worry about that. But, I mean, Lowell just read in Romans about, and there's quite a few other verses, and I'm not going to go into them, about how it is wrong. In Leviticus, it's called an abomination. So what about the other laws? Do we need to keep those as well? That's the argument. And I'm not going to go into all that, but those other laws were a temporary thing, and I think that we're studying in Hebrews, and whoever wrote the book of Hebrews is showing that, no, those things aren't. We're not. That was for the Jews for a specific time. It's not for us today. Some of the more far-out arguments are that Jonathan and David were homosexual lovers, and there's quite a few others, that the real sin of Sodom was that they weren't hospitable because of Ezekiel, but there's other places that talks about Sodom and how terrible and wicked their sins were. And you know that Jesus never spoke about it. But we have this God in nature that he says that no one is without excuse. If we look at God, so I think we can appeal to the creation that God has made. And so if there was a creator, then we need to know him. And if he is the one, that we're not the one setting the rules. I guess that's what it boils down to, is who makes the rules. And not all, and things aren't relative, like abortion and marriage, whatever, but there are absolutes. And I guess this relativism, I came across this story. It says, relativism may appear impressive on the surface, but it is philosophically false. It is logically contradictory, morally inadequate, and existentially unlivable. Consider the true story of a philosophy student who wrote an ethics paper arguing that there are no absolutes and everything is relative. Judged by the research, documentation, and scholarship, the paper deserved an A. The professor, however, gave it an F with a note explaining, I do not like blue covers. When the student received his paper, he was so upset that he stormed into the professor's office protesting. This is not fair. This is not just. I shouldn't be graded on the color of the cover, but on the content of my paper. The professor looked the student in the eye and asked, was this the paper which argued that there are no objective moral principles, such as fairness and justice, and that everything is relative to one's taste? Yes, yes, that's the one, replied the student. Well then, said the professor, I do not like blue covers. The grade will remain an F. Suddenly the young man understood that moral absolutes are unavoidable, and that in fact he also believed in moral principles such as fairness and justice. Furthermore, he was expecting them to be applied in his case. So, and I think that's where often that, people do, the relativism is that it's something is neither right nor wrong, and yet they would accuse Christians of not being consistent. Well, if there's neither right nor wrong, what does it matter? I think moral relativism is probably the big danger that's out there, and that's where I think that the gay marriage thing comes in, and even a lot of the other ills. And I was even thinking about this abortion thing before this Planned Parenthood thing came about. But people seem to be outraged that they're selling body parts, not that they're actually killing the babies. And I guess that's the part that shocks me, is that they're killing the babies in the first place. To me, that's the part that's wrong. That it's not just that you're making money off of it. After all, I think that's why they're in the business, is to make money. So I think that we, in order to reach people that aren't Christians, I don't think that we can necessarily argue from the scriptures till they see that there has to be a higher power to appeal to, and that's who we are appealing to, and then live our lives so that they see Christ's love in us, and have a relationship with them. And I think that makes a big difference, rather than just what they read in the news or hear or see in front of abortion clinics, people protesting gay rights or whatever. That people, I guess that's the other thing, that people seem to define, homosexuality seems to define them. Well, we don't define people by the fact that they're adulterers or pedophiles. And then they say, well, then, I can't help it. God made me this way. Well, we all have sinful tendencies. That takes away our own accountability, because there's many things that we're tempted to do that we don't do, that we shouldn't be doing. And Paul talked about that. And I didn't go into those scriptures, but where he talks about some of those things, he actually talks about homosexuality. He says, and such were some of you, but they are no longer. I think that Christ can change those people. And they argue that, well, that's just who I am and I can't help it. But there are so many stories about people who actually, with the love of Christ, changed their lives. So I think if people are actually searching for truth, I think we can find it. But if have our minds stubbornly made up, then it's hard to find that. So, anyhow, that's all I have. Thank you.